Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is an Iceland-based human rights campaigner, 9/11 researcher, and musical composer. He was born in Palestine in 1941 to Jewish refugees from Germany and grew up in Jerusalem in a neighborhood where Jews, Muslims, and Christians lived in peace together. It has permanently affected his view of the world and of the situation we find ourselves in today. We're going to discuss his research on 9/11 and its significance. It's a great pleasure to welcome back to the show Elias Davidson. Elias, welcome.
Hello, hello again. Hi.
This is such a pleasure. You are among the two or three scholars involved in 9/11 research whom I most admire, and it's a great pleasure to have you on the program today.
Yes, by the way, just a little correction. My family and myself moved from Iceland to Germany in July. So now I'm living in Germany, and I'm talking to you from Germany.
Ah, very good, very good. I'm glad we got the right number.
Okay.
I know that you have been especially concerned about the crusade against the Islamic world that the Bush administration launched based upon their claims about the events of 9/11, claims that students of these events have been able to disprove virtually across the board.
Yes, exactly. If I'd like to remind our listeners, in the Middle Ages, some Christian groups tried to incite against the Jews, and so they propagated the myth that some Jews had killed a Christian boy to use his blood for the Easter festivities. This was a blood libel, after which Jews were killed. There were pogroms against Jews because people believed the Jews used the blood of Christians to celebrate the Easter, the Pesach Seder, you know. And today we live something similar in what I call the blood libel against the Muslim terrorism. The blood libel was set in motion on the day of 9/11, where the American government promoted the myth that 19 Muslims, fanatic Muslims, hijacked four planes in a suicide operation in the name of Islam and killed 3,000 people. Well, this was the blood libel, the foundational blood libel, which led to the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, the Patriot Act, and a diverse garden variety of human rights violations across the world. I consider that a very important issue, and I think that the blood libel is exactly as true, the current blood libel against Muslims is exactly as true as the blood libel of the Middle Ages against the Jews.
It's sad to say, but lies, even big lies, can be especially effective in affecting a community where the events of 9/11 appear to have involved the use of violence and threats of violence in order to instill fear into the American population in order to manipulate us for political purposes, which, as you well know, turns out to be the classic definition of terrorism. So that if all of the research that we have been doing that implicates elements of the American government are in these events are well-founded, then the American government appears to have been using terrorism on the American people.
Of course, of course. Now, my research is basically very... I try to avoid speculation. What I have done in my research is basically to approach 9/11 as any criminal investigator. So I began at the basics. Say, that means who were on the scene of the crime, Now, to find out who was on the scene of the crime, we have information about who boarded the aircraft which were reportedly crushed on 9/11. Now, I'm leaving the question of identification of the aircraft now in parentheses. I leave it out of the discussion. I just discussed the boarding of the aircraft.
Yes.
And in my research, I found out that the U.S. government, which normally would have access to all the evidence, did not produce even a shred of evidence proving that any of the 19 so-called hijackers boarded any of these four aircraft. There is not a single shred of evidence proving that they boarded these aircraft. Their names don't appear on any certified passenger lists. There are no boarding cards found on the which they have, which would link them to the boarding. And what is more sinister is that there is not a single person who actually said to have observed the boarding of these planes. Now, normally you will have for each plane at least two people who would tear the boarding cards, and these people, they would be eight people for four planes. These people would be normally expected to testify, to have seen the passengers and the alleged hijackers board the aircraft and seen these people the last alive. Now, there is not a single testimony of any of these people, and their names have never been revealed. So it is very possible that these people don't exist at all, that there were nobody witnessing the boarding of the aircraft, because neither the passengers nor the hijackers boarded any aircraft, or, alternatively, they boarded another aircraft of which the identity must not be revealed. So everything surrounding the boarding of the aircraft is kept in secrecy today. It is one of the biggest secrets of 9/11.
Yes, yes, wonderful points. And the a lawsuit brought by some of the survivors of the passengers who were killed has been derailed in New York by a judge who decided that they had to determine the amount of punishment before they determined liability, trying to keep the case basically stifled so that the airliners, which I think are not willing to take legal responsibility here, never have to testify, that as a matter of fact the whole thing is a hoax that was created by the American government.
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. This, you are talking about Hellerstein. Alvin Hellerstein, the judge in New York, I think.
Yes, I am indeed, and it's a bizarre case. I've never heard of anything like it, a complete violation of standard principles of jurisprudence and courtroom procedure, Elias, where you have to determine liability before you sort out proportionality in order to determine the punishment that should be imposed.
Well, I fully agree with you. Well, basically, you see, the U.S. government has done everything to prevent any discovery procedures which would, in fact, oblige the airlines to produce passenger lists or any such documents so that you could see what happened at the boarding.
It's absolutely stunning. We'll return to this point with my special guest, Elias Davidson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. Special guest today is a human rights activist, a 9/11 researcher, a musical composer who now resides in Germany. He has published numerous articles in distinguished journals related to international law, and he is among the two or three most important scholars doing research on 9/11, in my opinion. A recent piece of his, which I'm including in my second edited collection on 9/11, which will be entitled The 9/11 Controversies, is entitled There Is No Evidence That Muslims Hijacked Planes on 9/11. His name is Elias Davidson, and I'd like to read the first paragraph of the conclusion of that study to reflect what he has discovered from his research. As shown above, the U.S. authorities have failed to prove that the 19 individuals accused of the mass murder of 9/11 had boarded the aircraft, which they allegedly used to commit the crime. No authenticated original passenger lists bearing their names have been released. No one is known to have seen them board the aircraft. No video recordings document their boarding. No boarding pass stub is known to exist. And there is no proof that the alleged hijackers actually died at the known crash sites because their bodily remains were not positively identified and the chain of custody of these remains was broken. In my opinion, Elias, this is one of the most important results anyone has produced in relation to 9/11 research. And, of course, it's been further strengthened by David Ray Griffin's discovery that five or six or more of the alleged hijackers actually are alive and well and living in the Middle East, some of whom have been interviewed by the British media.
With due respect to David Griffin, I have the faint feeling, I cannot say I can prove it, I have a faint feeling that the story of the so-called living hijackers is a red herring in so far that it implies that they were hijackers, you see. If you say they are living hijackers, you imply that they were hijackers.
Yeah.
However, we don't know whether they were hijackers.
Yeah, I sort of qualify by that saying the alleged hijackers, since obviously if there had been any, if they'd been aboard the plane, they would no longer be alive today.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that the story of these living so-called hijackers is basically... is it basically a red herring? It does not add very much to the research, in my opinion, because there is no evidence whatsoever that any of the persons named by the FBI, including those who are supposedly living, did at all board those aircraft. So, and these eight people, or whatever number they are, have nothing to do with these events. I don't think that they were involved in any way in these events. So what is probably the truth is that there were some people who used these names and who were asked to learn to fly in Florida and so on, but we don't know really who these people are, because we are just presented with fake names, fake photographs, and whatever.
So yeah. If you look at David Ray Griffin's book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, on page 19
yes.
of chapter 1, it begins, six alleged hijackers still alive. Here he's pointing out some of the problems with the official account, and he begins by saying, one problem is that at least six of the 19 men officially identified as the suicide hijackers reportedly showed up alive after 9/11. And he goes on to discuss it. In fact, a colleague of mine, Kevin Barrett, whom you may well know as a very active 9/11 supporter, flew all the way to the Middle East, to Morocco, a year ago in order to pursue one of them who was purportedly flying for Moroccan Airlines. He was unable to actually get a hold of the guy, but, I mean, he was sufficiently convinced of his existence that he flew there. What I think, Elias, is the case is if you could produce one of these guys on television, it would have a tremendous psychological impact on the American people.
Well, you may be right. I don't know exactly what kind of impact, because if you're looking at the website of the FBI, the FBI itself says attempts to, you know, I'm citing directly what is standing on the FBI website, attempts to confirm the true identities of these individuals, of the hijackers, are still underway.
Yes, yes. Well, they have to be equivocal. They have to be vague and ambiguous because they know otherwise. If they make specific claims, they can be subject to refutation. So they can only defend the remote plausibility of their account if they are elusive in their claims.
Exactly. So anyhow, I prefer not to even to discuss the issue of hijacking, because as long as we have no proof who boarded these aircraft, we must decide to reject the official account as totally unfounded, And basically, if the U.S. government, which is in fact both has the capacity and responsibility to establish the names of those who boarded the aircraft and the names of the hijackers, if the U.S. government after 7 years did not produce any evidence whatsoever, we must reject the official account as totally unfounded. And there are a number of implications which I would like to mention here.
Sure, please do.
The implications are three of those. The first one is that if there is no evidence of any Muslims who have boarded the planes, any person who is openly expressing the accusing Muslims of the crime of 9/11 or implying that Muslims or Arabs committed that crime is engaging in very grievous defamation. And I think it is very important that any decent person who comes across such accusations should demand that that person be dismissed from his job or removed from office.
Yeah.
Because this is absolutely unacceptable that anybody slanders another person, an innocent person, of mass murder without any evidence to back it up.
But, of course, the Bush administration has been in precisely that role. So what you're really suggesting is individuals that run as high as the president and vice president of the United States really deserve to be impeached and removed from office on this ground.
Of course, I agree with you. But I'm talking here about everybody else. I'm talking about journalists, editors, academics,
yeah,
politicians, any person at whichever level who is writing publicly or expressing publicly the opinion that Muslims committed this crime is basically a dangerous person, because he is accusing innocent people of one of the most horrendous crimes.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Elias Davidson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is a distinguished scholar of the events of 9/11, who has turned his attention to the broader issue of the war on terror from the point of view of criminology, the legal and moral perspectives, and arguing in favor of human rights and the necessity to be very critical in upholding them and not to commit blood libels by accusing, for example, Islamic fundamentalists of having committed the crimes of 9/11 in the absence of evidence, including his own research, which establishes that the United States authorities have failed to show that they were even aboard the planes. This article is so good, I want to recommend it to everyone. You can find it easily by doing a Google search. Just enter the name Elias Davidson with two S's. Elias Davidson, comma, no evidence on Google is sufficient to turn up the article and others by this very fine scholar. Elias, I might mention a couple of corroborating considerations. John Lear, who's the son of the designer of the Learjet and one of our nation's most distinguished pilots, has observed that in order for a commercial carrier to leave a terminal, it has to submit an envelope that includes a passenger manifest and a checklist about the plane being prepared for its trip. None of those envelopes have ever been produced for any of these four aircraft. And Colonel George Nelson, an Air Force air crash investigator who's now retired, has pointed out that while each of these planes has thousands of uniquely identifiable component parts, the government has yet to produce any one of those parts from any of the four crash sites.
Yes, I fully agree with you, and I'm both agreeing, and I know this is true what you're saying. I would like to continue on the point we left before,
yes,
namely on the fact that it is morally abject to accuse an innocent of mass murder.
Yes.
Now, I would just want to tell you one thing which might sound quite provocative in American ears. Everybody, or probably most of the listeners, have heard of Mohammed Atta, who is considered the lead hijacker from 9/11.
Allegedly,
well, my position as a legal scholar is that Mohammed Atta is innocent of any crime. He is innocent for the simple reason that his guilt was never proved beyond reasonable doubt. In fact, there is no evidence at all. I'm not talking about even a guilt beyond reasonable doubt, which is the criminal standard. There is not even a slight kind of evidence proving that he was guilty of any crime.
Yeah.
The only offense which I am aware that he was guilty of is fast driving. He was arrested at one time in the United States for fast driving, and that is the only offense I know of that he committed. The rest of that, he did not. And then I ask simply, who killed Mohammed Atta? Because he disappeared. And I have a reason to suspect, because he never appeared nowhere, that he was killed. The question is, who killed him? He was not on the plane which crashed, because his name doesn't appear nowhere, so he disappeared. So probably he was killed, and we must know who killed him. The same applies to a person called Ziad Jarrah from Lebanon, a playboy from a rich family in Lebanon. I talked to the family, and they are very, very, they are absolutely convinced that Ziad Jarrah had nothing to do with this crime of 9/11. Yet he is mentioned as the pilot of United Airlines 93. Now, Ziad Jarrah, the same thing. He was probably killed by whom, we don't know. And I think that human rights workers and decent people have the obligation to demand an investigation about the killing of these 19 alleged terrorists.
Oh, I think you're completely right, Elias, because absent evidence they were on the plane, we have no reason to believe, in fact, they were killed in the crashes. But yet it might be extremely important for the conspirators who were actually responsible to ensure that none of them turned up in a public place where they could be identified and contradict the official account.
So, therefore, I'm calling you to all those who listen here, first of all, to Muslims, and also to other human rights workers and to decent people, to demand simply what happened to these 19 people. Where did they die? Exactly. And another thing which I'd like to impress upon people, that until now the 9/11 movement has been rather defensive. We have been saying, well, the official account is not plausible and so on. However, we did not take the offensive. And I think this is a mistake, because those who have been peddling the official account have been defaming innocent people. They have been paving the road to two wars of aggression. These people are absolutely, they are dangerous people. Those who are peddling the official account don't engage in some kind of academic exercise. They have been paving the road to mass killing. And these people should be removed from office. They should be removed from the positions of journalism. They should be denounced as dangerous people for society, for humankind, because they are peddling an allegation, an accusation against Muslims, which they did not substantiate.
Yes, yes, yes. And there are lots of reasons to believe that these people were not Islamic fundamentalists either. Daniel Hopsicker's book, Welcome to Terrorland, for example, offers dozens upon dozens of reasons for doubting that they were of the kind, the character that would be involved in a suicidal act of this kind. Apparently he loved pork chops, he liked to party, he was a heavy drinker, he snorted coke, he was a stylish dresser, he wore expensive jewelry, he lived for 2 months with an American stripper, lingerie model. It goes on and on. This just is not the sort of person that would commit the crime attributed to him on the basis of his religious fanaticism.
Of course, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You know, we can discuss 9/11 from many, many, many points. However, what I have been trying to do, instead of diluting the discussion into the characters or the personalities of these people, I simply say the U.S. government has not proved its case.
Yes.
And because of that, no one is entitled to accuse Muslims or anybody else for this crime, because there is no proof who boarded these planes.
That's right, because under any appropriate standard of human rights, you're entitled to the presumption of innocence until you're proven guilty.
Exactly. So there is, in fact, no need to discuss the alleged personality of these 19 people. There is absolutely no need. If people want to do it, please do it. But from a criminology, from a legal point of view, the fact that there is no evidence that they at all boarded the planes completely disposes of the whole question from the outset. There is no need to discuss Al-Qaeda, no need to discuss Osama bin Laden, no need to discuss what they did in the U.S., because basically the whole story is a fraud, because the U.S. government has not substantiated its claim.
Yes, absolutely. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Elias Davidson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today resides in Germany. He's a human rights activist, a 9/11 researcher, a musical composer. He's done some of the best work on 9/11 of which I am aware, including a recent study showing that the government has no proof that any Islamic fundamentalists, any of the alleged hijackers, actually boarded the alleged aircraft that were allegedly used in the attacks of 9/11. There's a lot of allegations there, Elias, and there's very little evidence to substantiate any of them.
Little evidence is maybe an understatement.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there is basically no evidence. See, the thing is that when I was writing in one of my draft that there is no shred of evidence, and somebody took me on that particular word, no shred of evidence, and he mentioned some kind of footnote in the 9/11 commission which indicated that there was one person at one of the airports who said she might have recognized one of the hijackers, but she was not at the boarding. So there was maybe one shred of evidence, but it was not conclusive. So this was everything that person could find to counteract my study.
Well,
and I must say that it's very interesting that the study where I'm really showing that there is no evidence, I sent it to many people who believe in the official story, and some of these people were corresponding with me back and forth a few times. And after they received that report, they did not contact me anymore.
The claim is made that Mohammed Atta had a suitcase that didn't make it aboard the plane that was discovered at the Boston airport and had a manual like a hijacker's manual and a list of his 19 co-conspirators, which is, in my opinion, absurd on its face, but this is one of multiple ridiculous claims made by the government on behalf of its purported support for its story.
Well, of course, it's no problem for the government to have planted a suitcase or even having him bring a suitcase and then taking him somewhere else and murdering him. Basically, it is not very important. What is important is in relation to the crime itself, that even if there were such a suitcase and even if it contained all these things, it would not prove that he boarded American Airlines 11. And this is a very important point, because, you see, we can be tracked, we can be led to all kinds of false discussions about this suitcase, whether it was found, what it contained, and so on, and people will discuss back and forth about this suitcase and forget the essential point, that there is no evidence that he at all boarded American Airlines 11. Now, if he didn't board 11, I couldn't care about all the suitcases which he could have left here and there. They don't matter in relation to the allegation that he committed the murder. You see what I mean?
Of course. Isn't there an allegation of a passport? Was it not Atta's passport that's supposed to have survived the collapse and the destruction of the Twin Towers?
Well, basically, it was not his. It was another of the alleged hijackers, which was found on the street. I don't remember the name of that guy. But in any case, this is one of these fake kind of evidence,
yeah,
which they tried to plant here and there. Well, in fact, in my article, I describe all of these items which were found on the 9/11 and the day after. I describe all of these elements which of so-called evidence, incriminating evidence, which were as if they were really planted in order for the FBI to find it straight away.
Yeah.
Of course, this is very obvious to anybody who just sees the compilation of that kind of items. He would straight away see that these items were planted in order to create a legend. But basically, I don't really even want to. My research is very meticulous, so I don't want to go into too much speculation. It is obvious to anybody that this is very probable planted. But even if we don't, if we dismiss this kind of question, if we disregard this kind of question, the rest is totally clear that there was no evidence that they boarded these planes. So basically, we should dismiss everything and we should consider all the evidence, so-called all the incriminating evidence and all the stories as part of the huge deception scam.
As you well know, Zacharias Moussaoui, who was alleged to be the 20th hijacker, was put on trial for punishment in April of 2006 after having been convicted in April of 2005. But in 2006, he was being tried for whether he should suffer the death penalty or life imprisonment for being involved in the events of 9/11, whereas a year before, he was convicted of involvement in a completely different plot to hit the White House with a plane in order to free the blind sheik involved in the events of 1993. So the government was playing a shell game with the American people.
Of course, yeah. I mean, the Zacharias Moussaoui trial is one of the worst taints on the U.S. justice system, which I know of. It is absolutely a shattering indictment of the justice system, and not only of the court itself and of Judge Brinkema, who really, I must say, completely caused their own disrepute. But I believe that it was also an indictment of the so-called defense attorneys of Moussaoui,
yeah,
who colluded with the prosecution.
I think they have to have. I mean, he was, of course, equipped with a 10,000-volt stun belt, which no doubt would have made him very cooperative. But they played gave a transcript of the alleged cockpit voice recording from Flight 93, where you find the passengers discussing whether or not to use a drink cart to try to crash into the cabin, get through the cabin door. Other elements where a member of scholars pointed out to me that cockpit voice recordings don't record voices in the passenger compartment, one indication it was a fraud. Plus, at the end, it gives the voices of the alleged hijackers who are about to crash the plane saying, Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, which, of course, is Arabic for God is great, God is great. But an Islamic member of scholars pointed out that there's a prayer in Islam for every occasion, and the right prayer if you're facing imminent death is not Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, but rather in Arabic, there is but one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, so that those who were doing the script for this thing didn't know enough to get it right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're absolutely right. The Moussaoui trial, in fact, the defense attorneys entered into so-called stipulations. I don't know if the listeners are aware of this word. Stipulations.
Yes.
Are,
yes.
Stipulations are a list of facts which the defense and the prosecution agree upon that the court does not have to prove in court. So the defense attorneys of Moussaoui had him sign a list of stipulations which say that the court does not have to prove A, B, C, D, E, F, G. All of these are facts related to 9/11, including what happened on that day. So basically, the defense said, we don't have to prove what happened on 9/11. We take it for proven.
Yeah.
And this is, and this, if the defense attorneys would have demanded that this would be proved in court, they would have, of course, forced disclosure of passenger lists and other documents, which would have shown that 9/11 was a hoax. But the defense played into the government's plan by agreeing to these stipulations and letting Moussaoui sign these stipulations.
And it had to be mutual connivance, as you suggest.
Yes.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Elias Davidson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is an international human rights activist and 9/11 investigator who was born in Palestine in 1941 to Jewish refugees from Germany. He grew up in Jerusalem in a neighborhood where Jews, Muslims, and Christians lived in peace together, which made a profound impact upon him. And I think he is acutely distressed by the blood libel being committed by the United States on the followers of Islam for the events of 9/11, when the government has adduced no proof whatsoever that these alleged 19 Islamic fundamentalists actually boarded the planes, much less hijacked them and committed the crimes that they're alleged to have committed. I was fascinated, Elias, in relation to the Moussaoui trial, how he was being being subjected to a second trial to determine punishment, whether it should be life in prison or the death penalty, on the grounds that if he had come forward to inform authorities about the plot afoot, that they might have saved lives. But that's preposterous on multiple grounds, including not least of all, as Webster Tarpley pointed out to me, that the Fifth Amendment doesn't require any of us to incriminate ourselves. So he didn't have any legal obligation to do that.
Well, of course, the whole trial is marred by so many irregularities. And these irregularities are hierarchical. There are different levels of irregularities. This irregularity which you mentioned is of course obvious, because even if he did not disclose anything he knew, he did not cause the events to happen. I mean, if the fact that you don't reveal information and about impeding crime does not make you a participant in the crime. Even if he knew. But of course, the whole thing is, of course, absolutely ridiculous, because there is no causality between his alleged silence and the events themselves. However, there are other things which I find even more distressing more distressing about this trial is the fact that the Moussaoui was assigned defensive public defenders. Their name were Edward McMahon, Alan Yamanoto, Gerald Zirkin, Kenneth Stroccoli, and these people engaged in stipulations. It means they had him sign, and they signed themselves a stipulation in which it is stated the following: it is hereby stipulated and agreed by between the United States of America and Zakaria Moussaoui, the defendants, that A, B, C, and the first item is that on September 11, 2001, approximately 8:46, hijackers Mohammed Atta, Abdul Aziz Al-Omari, Satam Al-Sukami, and Wad Sherry flew American Airlines Flight 11 into North Tower at the World Trade Center in Manhattan. The plane struck between floors 94 and 98 in roughly the center of the north face of the building. The North Tower collapsed at 10:29, approximately 1 hour and minutes after the flight crash. And two is the next plane and so on. I'd like to mention another of these stipulations in which both the government and Moussaoui agreed that at 8:21 a.m., the transporter of Flight 11 was turned off in the cockpit, make it more difficult for air traffic control to identify the flight. Now, Moussaoui was at that time in the prison. He was not a witness to what happened in the plane. Yet, his lawyers let him stipulate these facts as if they were proven facts. And so there are page after page after page of facts of which Moussaoui could not have known.
where he had no personal knowledge and no evidence was adduced, and yet it would enable the government to claim that these points had been established in a court of law.
Exactly. Now, you see, when you are reading all that, of course, people would say, well, the lawyers did not object to it. The defense lawyers didn't object. Accordingly, we must believe that this is true. Now, these lawyers are traitors to their profession. I have in front of me the model rules of the American Bar Association Model Code of Professional Responsibility. One of the rules, number 4, says it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Similarly, Model Code says a lawyer shall not engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. And misrepresentation is knowingly made or where it is made with reckless ignorance of the truth or falsity thereof. No actual knowledge of or intent to deceive is necessary.
These guys are subject to disbarment if there were any justice here.
Exactly. I, in fact, sent a letter to the American Bar Association, but they said that they cannot deal with my complaint for some procedural reason. So I don't really know what procedure I should follow. However, it is very important to notice that today we cannot even rely that defense lawyers in terrorist trials will actually defend the accused, because they would connive with the prosecution, as has been shown in the Moussaoui trial. So I believe that anybody who is following the justice system in the United States should be very concerned about what happened there.
One of the most astonishing developments, which had to be a terrible embarrassment to the prosecution, was a testimony by an FBI agent who had been following Moussaoui, who said that he'd reported to his superiors his suspicions that he might be learning to fly a plane in order to commit a terrorist act. He even mentioned the Twin Towers as a possible target, though he later said that was just a lucky guess. But he testified he'd reported to his superiors his suspicions not once or twice, but 70 times. And I say 5 or 6 might be simple incompetence. When you get to 24, 25, obviously criminal neglect. When you get to 70 times, it's obvious this was a matter of policy, official policy, that they were going to keep these guys under wraps in order to roll them out as patsies when the government itself perpetrated these atrocities on the American people.
Yes, exactly. So basically he was protected. Moussaoui was a protected agent, and they didn't want to touch him. What they did to him in prison after that, I really don't know. They may have brainwashed him. They may have caused him to be mentally sick. I have no idea. What is clear that the whole treatment of Moussaoui is such a disgrace for the United States, I have no words for that.
It was clearly a show trial of the kind that Stalin used to put on in the Soviet Union. It's one of the most shocking, embarrassing, and irresponsible acts of the American government that I've ever witnessed.
Yes, I agree with you. And I really wish Americans to get rid of such corrupt lawyers and judges. I don't know how to do that, but I think that is the Moussaoui case is a very clear example of that.
Yes, yes. I think law schools should use an example of the abuse of the legal process and teach future prosecutors and defense attorneys about exactly what took place on that tragic occasion.
Jim, I very much commend that idea. Yeah.
Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Elias Davidson. We'll be right back. My special guest today is a human rights activist and 9/11 researcher whom I greatly admire. And he has been pursuing the issue from the point of view of a legal, criminological, jurisprudential, and especially a moral perspective, which I also endorse completely. Elias, I know there's many points you'd like to make about the moral dimensions of what's been going on here in terms of the allegations advanced by the American government based upon flimsy or non-existent evidence, so I'd like for you to have the opportunity to discuss those.
Well, basically, let's put it very simply. Suppose the media will publicize the claim that your brother, who has disappeared 1 week ago, has murdered the whole population of an old age home, but you don't see the brother, he disappeared, and the media will publicize allegations according to which he murdered all these inhabitants of the old age home. But the media would not provide any evidence for that. What would you do? You would be enraged. I'm sure they would be enraged that such allegation would be done without any proof being adduced. Well, that's exactly what the U.S. government has been doing concerning the 19 alleged hijacks of 9/11. It has alleged that these people committed the crime without producing any evidence whatsoever that these people were at the scene of the crime and they did commit the crime. And what are journalists doing? They are just promoting this kind of allegations on the headlines. Innumerable academics have written books and articles based on these allegations. U.S. courts have used these allegations as if they were proved, and have sentenced people to perpetuity on the basis of these allegations. Politicians have been supporting wars against other countries on the basis of these allegations. The UN Security Council even accepted without any question these allegations, without even asking for any evidence. So we have here a monumental fraud perpetuated on the entire humankind not only by the U.S. government, by many other governments who connived with the U.S. government in not asking any question. And here we are, in fact, not only dealing with the U.S. problem, we are dealing with a problem which is affecting the entire humankind. Because most governments are basically happy to have in their hands the war on terror, so they can criminalize any opposition to their government within the own country. We have country like Algeria, which is very happy to criminalize the Islamic movement and claiming that they are all terrorists. We have Israel, which everybody who is opposing Israel is a terrorist. We have Turkey. We have Russia with its own Chechnya people. We have China with the Uyghur in West China. Philippines in the south of Philippines. There are opposition groups. So we have many governments who just love to have that handed to them, the idea that that the dissidents are terrorists. And so governments just collude and acquiesce to the myth perpetrated by the United States. And so we are really in trouble, all of us, but I think the American people have an advantage over many other nations, because the exposure of 9/11 as a hoax is very well developed in the United States. And I really pray that the American people will be the first to free the world from this kind of scourge.
You know, it's interesting, Elias. I've made visits to Greece, for example, where the leading investigative journalist of Greece put me on a 3.5-hour television program discussing 9/11 that was broadcast worldwide by satellite. I've been flown down to Argentina for a week, all expense paid, to give lectures on 9/11, where reporters published 7 different articles, 2 in the news service of the Republic of Argentina. I was interviewed for 20 minutes, a broadcast that was put out all over South America. I have found the international interest and objectivity to be far greater than any we can find in the United States, principally because the U.S. media is very much under governmental and corporate control.
I understand. Well, I appreciate. I of course don't know the situation in the U.S. I basically know the situation in Western Europe, which is probably not much better than the United States. In Iceland, no newspaper has dared at all to have any questions. In Germany, it is the same thing. In Denmark, it is the same thing. In France, it is the same thing. It is basically in all Western Europe very similar. Only very, very few journalists dare to raise any small questions.
So, it's really dismaying. I mean, you're talking about one of the most important events of recent history. In fact, a turning point in terms of the way in which relations have been conducted between nations, and yet the press of these various countries are unwilling or intimidated or apprehensive or controlled and not allowed to investigate it. This is outrageous.
It is. However, the question is now how we should engage with the media. How should we engage with politicians? There are at least two ways which I see. One is to try to convince them by giving them information. I have tried that. Many people of the 9/11 Truth Movement have tried to convince journalists, to convince politicians by letting them read documentation. I found that the results are very, very meager. I don't believe that they want to know the truth. I think that they are committed to the official account and hanging to it desperately for reasons of convenience, for reasons of their own prestige, for reason of job and security and so on. So the question is whether it would not be more effective to put the heat on them and simply denounce them for as being defamators, slanderers, and dangerous people. So one idea which I have been floating is to create database.
Let's return to this point after the break. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Elias Davidson. We'll be right back. Today my special guest is now German-based musical composer, human rights activist, and 9/11 researcher who has been making very important contributions, one of which I want to mention to you again, to wit, a study that he has published that recommends, that points out that the government has produced no evidence that these alleged 19 hijackers ever even boarded the alleged planes that were used in the attacks of 9/11. If you enter his name, Elias Davidson, with two S's, D-A-V-I-D-S-S-O-N, comma, no evidence, you'll immediately be taken to a copy of that article, which I'm going to include in my next collection of important studies about 9/11, which will be entitled The 9/11 Controversies. Elias, I know you have these many points to make about the moral aspects of the situation, so I'd ask you to continue.
Well, when we departed, I mentioned the idea that promoting the idea of the blood libel, the blood libel of the 21st century, according to which Muslim fanatics committed the crime of 9/11, it is important, I find, that to put on notice those people who peddle this myth, which is a very dangerous myth because it has already paved the road to two wars of aggression, to the Patriot Act, to the diminution of human rights and other harmful policies. Now, it is not enough to defend or to claim that the official account is wrong. It is very important to put on notice those people who are really dangerous to society, and I'm proposing the establishment of an international database of dangerous journalists, academics, and politicians, namely those people who are disseminating the blood libel of the 21st century, according to which the Muslims have committed the crime of 9/11, without any foundation, without any factual foundation for these kind of accusations. Now, those people I would like to include in the base are those who are deliberately and willingly disseminating accusations against Muslims for this crime without ascertaining that there exists reliable evidence incriminating the accused for the crime. They continue to peddle the blood libel against Muslims even after being informed that there is no evidence. I think that publishing the names of these people can provide a warning to those who who would be tempted to accuse innocents who no one has proved guilty of the mass murder of 9/11. And I think that the posting of their names on the web will give pause thinking to all those who today are recklessly saying that 9/11 was a work of some Muslims. I just don't know. I'm floating the idea, and I propose people to reflect upon it as a way to reduce the arrogance and this racism of those who recklessly are slandering Muslims and the 19 people who probably have murdered by the U.S. government on 9/11, to just recklessly slander these people without any, without impunity. I think these people have to pay a price for this kind of work. I'd like to remind also listeners that after World War II, in the Nuremberg trial, one Nazi official by the name of Julius Streicher was condemned to death because he disseminated lies upon the Jewish people. He was the editor of the anti-Semitic newspaper Der Stürmer, and he helped to pave the road to Auschwitz. I believe that those people who are paving the road to Afghanistan, to the murder of thousands of people in Afghanistan and Iraq, have to pay a price, at least a moral price, if not a legal price.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And, of course, this Bush administration is guilty of so many crimes against humanity that it may take us years to begin to get it sorted out.
I would like to see, as I say, the act not going only against the top leaders of the U.S. government, but against all those who have disseminated these lies, these accusations, without even asking a question about the evidence.
Yeah.
Because I understand that, of course, the U.S. government very probably committed this crime. I believe that the probability is quite high. However, there is another kind of responsibility, is responsibility of those out there in society, in the newspapers, in the universities, in the Congress, who have in fact accused Muslims without any foundation and thus have participated in a huge operation of defamation and slander.
Yeah.
And I think there you have much more possibility of engaging these people because these people are those who are much nearer the people. You can reach these people. You can put them on notice. You can tell them you are a bastard because you are accusing innocence.
Yes. Yes, I agree completely.
You see what I mean?
Yes. Yes, yes.
You see, you cannot reach the president, but you can reach any person who publishes an article in a newspaper or a magazine or wherever where he is where he is in fact slandering Muslims or implying that Al-Qaeda or some kind of a Muslim organization or whatever did commit the crime. And I think these persons have to be put on notice and put the heat on these people.
I think the idea of an international register of those who have defamed others on the basis of 9/11 events for which they have no evidence, so that you could establish a list of future defendants in a Nuremberg-style tribunal, is a simply wonderful idea, because by virtue of its very existence, it tends to inhibit those who would be reckless in their allegations, of whom there are many.
Exactly. Well, I will reflect upon it. Of course, it requires a lot of work, but I have already been thinking about the criteria of including the people in this kind of register and the way of handling such names in a way which will not include innocent people and include only those who are really doing harm, you see. It is very important that it is done properly.
Yes, exactly, with great care.
Yes.
Which is a reason why I believe you are a perfect person to do it, because you are so thorough, meticulous, and painstaking in everything you undertake.
Well, thank you very much. It's a work which not one person can do.
Yeah.
It is important that it is a group of people which with integrity and can do that. And I'm really looking for establishing such a group, but it may take some time.
I have no doubt. I know you have many other points you would like to press about responsibility here on 9/11, though that may be among the most important.
Yes, yes. Well, another point which I'd like to raise here tonight before we leave is not directly related to 9/11, but with the war on terror. And the point is that the FBI actually has a policy, and I'm not talking about all the FBI in the United States, but I think that there is a policy.
Stand by. We'll be right back with a discussion of the war on terror with my special guest, Elias Davidson. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today we're concluding a conversation about 9/11, especially from the perspective of human rights issues and questions of morality, with Elias Davidson, who in my opinion is one of the most competent and accomplished students of the events of 9/11. I have recommended before, and I recommend again, go to Google, enter his name, Elias Davidson, with two S's, comma, no evidence, and you'll be brought to his recent study in which he demonstrates that the American government has produced no proof that the 19 alleged Islamic fundamentalists who were supposed to have hijacked these four aircraft and perpetrated these atrocities under the control of a guy in Afghanistan has been provided. We have no evidence that they were actually on those planes. No tickets, no photos, no seat charts, no names on manifests that are properly certified. It all appears to be a ruse, a hoax, and a sham, I'm sorry to say. We're now turning to his reflections on the war on terror, which itself appears to be a massive contrivance, a phony excuse to expend hundreds of billions of dollars more for the military-industrial complex and to appropriate natural resources, especially oil, of other countries under the guise or under the pretext of combating terrorism. It's an atrocious development, but it's been the signal contribution of the Bush administration to American foreign policy.
I wrote a paper called The Double Fraud on Humanity, which you published in your book, and which shows that basically the war on terror is a fraud based on the second fraud, the fraud of 9/11. Now, the fraud of the war on terror is basically very simple. It is being asserted that terrorism is a serious, or one of the most serious, threats to international peace and security. So this is the formulation made by the UN Security Council, which is just shows basically what kind of organ or what kind of institution the Security Council is. But leaving that aside, the fact is that terrorism is, I'm talking here about genuine terrorism carried out by non-governmental entities, is a minute problem in the global perspective. It dwarfs compared, for instance, to the number of people who are bitten by snakes or who are felled by lightnings.
Yeah.
Or who die in their own bath.
Yeah.
Or even the number of people who are murdered by their own wives or husbands.
Yeah.
Many more who are killed by their own husbands or wives.
Yes.
Than by terrorists.
This administration has fostered a climate of fear that's intended to be used to manipulate us to support its own political agenda, and a climate that's being perpetuated by the present candidate, John McCain, in his quest for the presidency, which we all hope and pray is going to be ill-fated.
Yes. Well, I'm not going to be drawn into the discussion about the elections. I would like just to add here that because there are so few Muslim terrorists, let me make just a remark. There are surely terrorist attacks committed by Muslims in occupied areas like in Palestine, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, people who are defending their countries and might, in some cases, attack civilians.
Yeah.
I personally am totally opposed to such methods, but these are probably the only real terrorist attacks which we face from Muslims. Because Muslims in Western countries are usually minorities who are extremely afraid to speak up, who are not oppressed, but basically lie down. So it is not at all in the interest of any Muslim in Western countries to try to commit terrorist acts. So what does the police, what does the authorities do? They hire convicted felons, tell them to make a deal with these felons. They say, okay, we will not put you to prison for 10 years, but only for 1 year, but you will become a Muslim, and then you will go out and recruit some young Muslims and try to set up a terrorist plot. You will receive money, you will receive equipment, you will receive everything you need, and your goal is to fish some gullible, some stupid Muslims and create a terrorist plot. And when you are through with that, we will just arrest the people and we will give you your money. And that's what now is being done all over, particularly in the United States, but also in Great Britain, in Germany, in France, in Belgium, in many countries. This is just the new policy of NATO, of the Western Alliance, to stage terrorists and to, by inducing felons and other people of this kind, to create terrorism. Now, there are three cases which I find myself, I followed very carefully, which some people, some listeners may know. One of the is a Florida group which was supposed to have to plan to destroy the Sears Towers, and these were completely stupid guys, and there was an FBI informer who induced them to prepare the plot. The other case was a completely hapless retired guy in New York who was approached by an FBI informant who was a convicted felon and with money, and he was coaxed or induced to prepare a plot to blow up the oil pipes at JFK Airport. This hapless Muslim did not even know how to do it and how to proceed. So the FBI informant had to buy for him the camera, had to drive him around, and so on. And this, you can read it in the court documents. It's nothing which I found myself. It is all public knowledge. And then you have the California gang, one of which was, in fact, a so-called guy who became Muslim in prison. And then he went out and he tried to fish some Muslims to attack Jewish targets. And the whole story is so surrealistic. I tried to follow it up and I found that it just doesn't stand. There were so many facts reported in the press which I could not at all find any evidence for. So this is this plot is linked with the city of Torrance in California. And so there is a plot in Germany which everybody is laughing about. I'm not going to detail it, but there are plots like this in France, in Germany, in Belgium, in Denmark, all over the NATO countries. You have these kind of plots being concocted by the intelligence services in order to prove that there is some terrorist plots. We are really in a bad shape when the police is trying to do that.
Well, you're talking about the beauty of terrorism, which is such a vague notion. You can blame any event anywhere in the world on terrorists and who's in the position to refute you, especially when you're using special forces or Delta teams or other agents working for the American government when they need a terrorist attack in order to respond to it, in order to increase tensions or fears in the United States, in order to affect an election. They can simply arrange it, have it occur, and then react to it as though it were genuine, playing both sides against the middle, where the middle in this case is the American people and the international community.
Exactly. So the final idea is that we will try to work for an international investigation on 9/11. And I, in fact, in an interview with the Iranian radio, I recommended that the Iranian government propose at the General Assembly of the United Nations that there would be an investigation of 9/11.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Wouldn't it be ironic if Iran were to conduct an investigation that were far closer to the truth than what the American government has provided?
Well, I hope that the Iranian government has the wits to do that.
Elias Davidson, I cannot thank you enough. I want to congratulate you for your excellent work of the past. I look forward to collaborating with you in the future, and I thank you so much for coming on this program with me today.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to address these things, and have a good night's sleep, Jim.
Thank you so much, Elias. My great pleasure, everyone. This is Jim Fetzer, your host. Thank you all for listening.